Coming up today, the deadly viruses lurking in the permafrost and what the Bruce Willis deepfake means for the future of Hollywood. You're listening to the Wired Podcast, your essential weekly guide to the future of tech, science, business, and culture. I'm your host, Amit Katwala, and joining me this week are Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
Grace Brown.
Hello.
And Will Bedingfield.
Hi.
This was the week when shares in Meta plunged after the company reported disappointing advertising sales for the third quarter of the year. Hundreds of billions have been wiped off the firm's value since the start of 2022.
This was the week Elon Musk entered the Twitter offices for the first time, carrying a sink and tweeting, "Let that sink in." Very funny.
And it was also the week when we found out that global carbon emissions from energy should peak in 2025. That's according to analysis from the International Energy Agency. This is due to big investments in green energy, and it is good news, but we still need to do way more, as a UN study found that even with government pledges to cut emissions, we're still on track for 2.5 degrees Celsius of heating.
And finally, on Tuesday morning, the messaging app WhatsApp went down for about 2 hours. The company did not disclose the reason for the outage, although some people joked that the weight of messages being sent over Diwali in India, where WhatsApp has its largest market, could have caused the outage.
It was quite disconcerting when WhatsApp went down. I felt kind of cut off from the world. It's amazing how much communication now runs through those channels.
I felt great.
Much better. Just
so
free.
Yeah.
I was saying to someone that like so much British political discourse happens through WhatsApp that if this had happened a week earlier, Liz Truss may well still be the Prime Minister, because like all the kind of machinations and backstabbing and, you know, promise breaking all happens on WhatsApp these days.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to fun facts. Grace, what have you got for us?
So my fun fact is, contrary to popular belief, half of body heat is not lost through the head, and covering the head, usually via a hat, is no more effective at preventing heat loss than covering any other portion of the body. The myth is thought to have originated from experiments in the 1950s when US military researchers exposed subjects to frigid temperatures. While their bodies were bundled up, their heads were exposed and they were found to have lost more heat from their heads. But later studies found that at most you lose about 7 to 10% of your body heat through your head.
So is it kind of evenly distributed throughout the body heat loss, I think? So there's nothing that...
There's no body part that is significantly more vulnerable than others.
So if I chose not to wear socks and wore a hat instead, that would be fine. I'd be losing the same amount of heat.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. Matt Reynolds, what have you got for us?
So I had another medical adjacent fact for you, and I learned about a kind of surgery called tooth-in-eye surgery, which is actually exactly what it sounds like, and it's used to restore vision in some severe eye diseases where basically the lens kind of degenerates. So it works when doctors take out a bit of the tooth, they kind of file it down and they fit it with a lens and then implant that into the patient's cheek.
What?
I know, it's pretty wild. After a few months, it's taken out of the cheek and it's implanted in the eye. And this tech, I mean, this sounds like it was something that was happening in the Victorian era, but it was actually pioneered in the 1960s, and it works because the tooth is a neutral tissue that the body won't reject, and it can also hold a lens, and it's still used today in certain eye conditions.
Why the cheek?
Oh, I suppose it's just near the eye, so maybe it's like, I mean, would you want your tooth in your butt? I think it's like vulnerable to other things, so it seems like a convenient place to leave
it. If I was going to have a gross tooth lens implanted somewhere on my body, I'd probably not go for the face, to be honest.
I imagine what it is that you've probably got that area under a covering anyway, so maybe it's that, you know, you can just put it under, and I don't think it's the whole of a tooth. I don't think you're going to see someone have like a tooth eye. It's more like a kind of bit of the tooth that is used to hold it. So, I mean, yeah, why not put it in your tooth, in your cheek?
This is horrific. Thank you, Matt. Great fact. Okay, let's move to our first story, which is back with you, Matt Reynolds.
It is back with me. So I think we've had no end of bad news about the Arctic, but Grace, fortunately, you are here to tell us some good news that we don't have to worry about the Arctic and everything is okay. Is that right?
I'm going to say no, but, you know, good shot. So my story this week is about the Arctic. And like you said, we hear all about bad things about the Arctic, you know, sea levels rising, ice cap melting, polar bears losing their homes. But there's another thing that's happening in the Arctic due to climate change. And that is that the warming landscape is actually rewiring viral dynamics, meaning that it maybe has a potential to unleash new pathogens on us. The Arctic is warming nearly four times quicker than the rest of the world, and obviously that has disastrous consequences for the region and its inhabitants. And generally across the world, as the world is heating up, many species are expected to kind of up sticks and meander many miles away from their typical habitat, and that means that they're going to bring the various pathogens along with them for the ride. This means that previously unacquainted viruses and hosts are going to be meeting for the first time in a little meet cute. And this is potentially going to lead to some viral spillovers where a virus jumps from one reservoir host to another, just like what happened with SARS-CoV-2.
Well, I thought you were going to say, just like what happened in...
When Harry met Sally.
Yeah, exactly. Sleepless in Seattle or something like that. Okay, so this is a... Yeah, I didn't see that bit of the rom-com, but that this is a disastrous ending. And I suppose this will happen in both directions, because as the Arctic gets warmer, you're going to have species that whose range is extended, so they can go upwards, and then the kind of reverse happening for other species. So this like inherently makes sense, right? Species move around when their environments change. But do we actually know this is happening, and why do we know this is a risk? I mean, why are we talking about it today?
I think this has been a kind of a concern that's been on people's minds for a while. In maybe warmer parts of the world, like, we hear about mosquitoes are moving around a bunch, but in this particular case, you know, it occurred to the researchers that it was probably happening in the Arctic too, especially in a place where it's changing probably more so than anywhere else, or at least in the top 10 places that are changing the most due to climate change. So in this particular paper, a group of researchers tried to put a number to this idea of spillover risks, viral spillover, in the Arctic. So they went to this place called Lake Hazen, which is a freshwater lake in Canada that is located inside the Arctic Circle. And they took some samples of the soil and the lake sediment, and then basically just sequenced the genetic material that was in those samples just to see, you know, what was going on in there, what viruses were there, what hosts were in there. They also sequenced the genomes of the potential hosts in the air, including animals and plants and fungi. And then they did this kind of computer algorithm-y thing where they tried to gauge how likely it was that a virus might jump into a new species, which is, you know, viral spillover. So to do this, they looked at the genetic history of a virus and its typical host. If a host and a virus show kind of similar patterns in how they have evolved, it suggests that they've lived in tandem for a long time and that the virus doesn't really tend to move into new species. But if their patterns of evolution are very different, it suggests that the virus has spent time living in other hosts. It's probably jumped before, and it's probably more likely to do so again. So knowing the propensity of viruses in the regions to move species, they then used, like I said, a computer algorithm to estimate how climate change would probably alter the likelihood of them doing so. To do this, they used meltwater from glaciers as a kind of proxy for increasing temperatures. And they found that as temperatures rise and glacier runoff increases, the risk of viruses in the area jumping host goes up with it. And this is kind of a theory that's been around for a while as to why this happens. And basically, it's because as meltwater streams into the lake, it carries with it a bunch of sediment that it deposits at the bottom of the lake, which kind of upsets the lake's population, and in disturbing the environment, it tends to speed up a pathogen's genetic diversity and evolution against its like host immune defenses, which means that basically the host can't fight off the virus, changes host, blah, 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 SARS-CoV-2, etc.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I suppose in recent years, we've all become a little bit more acquainted with this viral spillover and this kind of host jumping than we'd like to be, because there's this idea that some of the time, a virus might end up in a new host, but it actually doesn't do anything because it doesn't have the kind of genetic makeup to be able to infect them.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you have that spillover happen enough times, and with the right genetic combinations, what you end up is with a new disease in a new population. And it's not just things emerging from the permafrost, which sounds kind of disturbing, kind of creepy, but people have started to ring alarm bells about how climate change would exacerbate existing infectious disease as well.
Yeah, I think this study is just like another example of just how climate change is going to completely throw our current knowledge of infectious disease out of whack. There was a recent massive review paper. I think they looked at 70,000 existing papers, and they came to the conclusion that out of the 375 known infectious diseases, over half of them, 218, are going to be aggravated by climate change if they're not already being aggravated. And the paper warned that the melting ice and the thawing permafrost in the Arctic could open up a Pandora's box of pathogens once frozen in time, which, I mean, does sound extremely dystopian, but it actually has already happened. In the summer of 2016, a 12-year-old boy in Siberia died of anthrax after a heat wave in the area thawed the frozen soil. It actually revealed a reindeer carcass that had been frozen, hidden for decades, and that reindeer carcass had some anthrax spores frozen along with it. So as the carcass thawed, so did the spores in its body. And then through this 12-year-old boy encountering that carcass, the outbreak went on to sicken some 90 people in the area, and it killed over 2,000 reindeer as well. And other studies have warned that if that wasn't enough, that thawing permafrost could also uncover antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
So there's all kinds of things to be worried about that might be lurking in the permafrost. But, you know, we've seen other studies, and we've talked about other studies that have talked about the risk of viral spillover from the animal trade or from farming or from humans encroaching on the rainforest and animal habitat. So if we're thinking about all these different places where humans interact with animals, or you know, animals and interact with viruses and all those things, and there are opportunities for spillover, is the Arctic something that now should be like top of our list in terms of a place where we might see a new outbreak, a new disease we didn't know about? Or is it just a contender, maybe a less likely contender than these other places?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the main takeaway, is that it's probably a contender, but maybe not top of our list in terms of what we should be worrying about. Like we already mentioned, you know, mosquitoes are already moving around a bunch. You know, we're encountering a ton of potential spillover events pretty much every single day. And the researchers emphasize that they cannot say that, yes, a pandemic will probably come from the Arctic. For right now, we can't say anything for sure, but it is a possibility. And like I said, yeah, we know climate change is already hastening the spread of insect-borne diseases in other parts of the world. But they said, you know, this doesn't mean that just because another pandemic isn't likely to come from the Arctic, it doesn't mean that we should wait to find out. And really, this study is just kind of, you know, another tool in the arsenal to argue that we really should be doing everything that we can to put the brakes on the climate crisis.
Horrifying stuff. Thanks, Grace. So other than slowing down climate change, there's not really much we can do to avoid mammothitis or something coming to kill us all in 50 years. Brilliant.
Well, I suppose you raised this point when we were chatting about this story, Grace, is that one of these worries is that people go visit these places more. Maybe they're extracting materials. Maybe it's tourism. And then maybe if you have, you know, maybe if humans can maybe get out of the Arctic a little bit, you know, non-indigenous people, the less you travel there, the less chance you come across viruses and animals. So maybe that could help a little bit.
Yeah, well, that came from, I read a really interesting study just in general how the Arctic is changing as it's melting and it's becoming accessible to non-native people and to tourists. There's like a whole branch of, like Matt and I were talking about, like doomism tourism, people going to go watch the glaciers melting, etc. But not just that, people are going exploring different parts of it, disrupting the natural habitat that the indigenous people have developed with it for centuries. And it's just, yeah, changing it and with unintended consequences probably.
Yeah, I know countries like Russia see the opening up of the Arctic as quite a big opportunity, but I guess as humans move into the area, as you said, Matt, then there's also risks that come with that opportunity as well. Fascinating stuff. For our second story this week, we're talking about Bruce Willis. The actor has been in the news recently, and Will has been investigating. Will, first off, welcome to the podcast. Your first appearance. Very excited to have you.
Yeah, second, I thought if I sat quietly, no one would ask me anything. But
I'm afraid not. That's not what we do here. So, Will, what's the story, and how did you come across it?
Well, I came across the story a way a lot of people did, which is they saw a viral video of Bruce Willis on the back of a boat for an advert for a Russian telecoms company. And he was... Well, he was speaking, I thought, in Russian, but then I asked one of our ex-colleagues who speaks Russian what he was saying, and it turned out he was just saying Mississippi. But basically, this wasn't actually Bruce Willis. He's retired. He has aphasia. It was actually a deep fake, which, for those who don't know, is a loose term applied to images or videos generated using AI that look real. You might have seen ones for Obama or Zelensky. And so... In this case, this tech was mapped onto another actor, their image, and was appeared to look like Bruce Willis. And then The Telegraph reported that Bruce Willis had sold his image rights, which turned out to be like completely wrong. So like representatives of Willis said that the star hadn't done that, and he had no relationship with the company that made it, called Deep Cake, if you can get the reference there. And then my colleague Stephen Levy spoke to the CEO of the company and told me that basically the company never claimed to own Willis's future rights, but had actually had a previous and mutually satisfying arrangement where Deep Cake digitized his appearance in a 2021 ad for Megafon. So that's the Russian telecoms company or cell network. They explained to Levy that they looked at 34,000 images from his earlier films, and that's how the AI made his image and mapped it onto another actor. So I recommend everyone read that story.
your story is more about the kind of legal and ethical implications of the technology rather than how it works, what it will mean if an actor like Bruce Willis were to actually, you know, sell his image rights to a company to be reused.
Yeah. So, yeah, mine was the legal implications. So in Levy's story, he says, who owns Bruce Willis? So mine's kind of investigating that proposition, I guess. And that's not only a concern for Hollywood actors. According to some experts, there's a bit of contention here that I think we'll get into. It sort of implicates everyone. It's sort of a kind of, it sets up a kind of dystopian future where like people's identities can be bought, sold and seized is the word that was used when I was speaking to someone about it.
So in the way that you might have your personal data sold today, it could be that you kind of get your very identity sold in future. So, I mean, how do you determine ownership over someone's likeness? And I guess this isn't necessarily a new conversation. There's been discussions about this being had for, I guess, as long as cinema's been a thing, right?
Yeah, so when I was researching it, I was hoping to do a comparison between the US and the UK, and in the end, I decided that was almost too complicated because it varies so widely legally between country and country, country to country, sorry. So I kept it to the US, and even there, it varies within states. So the scope of protection, actually, you can read, there's a link online in my piece where you can check your own state if you're listening in the US and see what kind of rights of publicity protections you have there. So anyway, in America in general, people have a right under various state laws, as I said, it varies state to state, but to limit unauthorized appropriation of their identities, and I'm just reading out here, particularly their names and likenesses, while others, and then others are sort of a bit more complicated and they're made by common or judge-made laws. And the sort of gold protection is something called the right of publicity, and that law bars unauthorized use of a person's name, likeness or voice or other indicia of identity without permission, usually for a commercial purpose, though it's kind of complicated, but yeah, usually commercial. Like, if I went on the internet and made a deep fake of Willis, like, I don't know, yippee-ki-yay-ing and in a, I don't know, a video game, I might, but I wouldn't necessarily run afoul of that right of publicity because it can, it sort of pertains to commercial rights. So if I went and then made a potato chip advert with him, you know, if I put him in a Walker's thing and then I said, like, you know, here's him eating salt and vinegar crisps and Bruce Willis loves salt and vinegar crisps, that would be... that would, in the US, fall afoul of the right of publicity. There are other areas where you can defame people, which is outside. That's settled by something called tort law. But yeah, in this case, the right of publicity would be the issue if he was put in one of those adverts.
So you could use it for like a creative purpose, but not for a commercial one. So you could pretty much put it in your like YouTube spoof video, but you couldn't sell vacuum cleaners.
Yeah, because it's protected under the First Amendment. It can't just be false.
Right.
There has to be this, and this is kind of vague, but there has to be an additional problem. And one, one of those additional problems could be defamation.
Right, right. So you couldn't use someone's likeness to make a video of them that would make them look bad, basically, or make them pretty.
No way, yeah.
So, I mean, how do actors feel about this? Obviously, Bruce Willis was happy for this company to do this on one occasion, but are actors thinking like, this is, you know, our livelihood's at risk, or are they thinking, you know, what role might these deepfakes play in Hollywood and what does the future look like?
Yeah, so actors unions, I spoke to SAG-AFTRA and they explained to me that they've been looking at it since like video games, sports video games, so like Madden if we're in the US or FIFA if you're over here. And when they were sort of blocky, you know, rubbish FIFA 2002 images of footballers, even then they were looking at it and being like, wait a minute, like this is not, you know, this is going to be a problem down the line. Well, first off, they're worried about being made obsolete by the technology. In the case of Bruce Willis, that's kind of obvious why that might happen there in a sort of dystopian future where actors are, you know, replaced by these deep fake images. And then another example they use is if you're speaking to if you sign away your image rights to the wrong company, they use the example from the episode of Friends where basically Joey, I want to get this right because I have seen this episode, but I can't remember it that well.
It is Joey.
It's Joey. Yeah. No, it's definitely Joey, but it's just, I think he ends up in an STD advert.
Yeah.
When he thinks he's just doing some modeling, and like, that would be essentially what would happen, but it would be even worse than that because it would be a deep fake speaking for you. So I had one expert told me like that essentially your image is being used, and you don't, I mean, I don't really need to explain how that would be a negative for the person. Yeah, TikTok had to settle a legal case around that issue recently. An actor that they employed, their voice was used in ways that they weren't agreeing to, basically, in broader ways.
Right. So I guess you could end up in a situation where you sold your rights, but then they get used in ways that you don't like. So I can see why that might be a problem for kind of actors breaking through, not wanting to jeopardize their future earnings. But for someone like Bruce Willis, he's kind of thinking, well, you know, or, you know, an actor of a similar age or in a similar era is kind of thinking, well, maybe I'm not going to do that many more big movies. And actually, I maybe want to like enable my relatives and descendants or whatever to make money off my huge success once I'm gone. So some of them are kind of thinking, well, I kind of want to cash in on this, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously their voices or images attain commercial value. In fact, when I was speaking to SAG-AFTRA, they were like, we don't like the term deepfake because we see it as a, we see deepfakes as a source of revenue. So we like prefer the term digital double or AI generated. And this is where there becomes this kind of argument over transferability of these publicity rights. So essentially for SAG-AFTRA, it's useful for rights to be able to be transferred to a third party so that those professionals can basically negotiate on the part of the person who's transferred them the rights on the actor. And then through that, you know, financial legal expertise, they can, maximize the value of the asset.
We've seen kind of some examples of this, like, or kind of parallel examples of this in the music industry, where we've seen like some of the big older bands selling their entire back catalogue to, you know, an investment company or whatever, selling the rights to all the music they've ever made up to a certain point to a company, so they get like a big payoff in the expectation that that company will then be able to use that back catalogue to make their money back after they're gone. And then the opposite thing is what we saw with someone like Taylor Swift, where she has really struggled because she hasn't had ownership over her own music. So I guess that's the kind of two routes that you go down, except instead of it being your back catalogue, it's your literal identity, your image, your voice, etc. So not everyone really agrees with that view of things, the way SAG-AFTRA sees things.
Yeah, so this took me like ages to understand, so I'm going to try and explain it clearly, but it's a bit hazy. I hope it's not as hazy in my mind as it was when I started writing the piece. But basically, that people, the idea of transferability of your right of publicity is not the same as Joey like authorizing use of his identity for money. It's more about ownership. So it's about a right of publicity being understood in the same way as like a, you know, a transferable property right or a patent or copyrights. So it's like able to be bought and sold. And so it sort of affects whether the right over a person's identity is transferred and taken away from them and owned by a third party. And so for some experts, this transferability could lead to people losing control of their personalities. That's what they believe. And as firms take full ownership of their identity rather than just a license used for the particular purpose. So the original, there's a one of the experts, Jennifer Rothman, wrote a really interesting article where she says that this idea originated in from studio lawyers in the 1950s who basically wanted to control the movies actors appeared in and the products they endorsed. And yeah, she also cites in a different article student athletes, and you know, basically by making their publicity rights transferable, you risk agents, managers, companies hoovering up their identities in the hope of like extracting future profit if they make it, basically, if they find big league success. Smaller actors and athletes in this view are and even average citizens are sort of in danger of losing control or signing away their names, this is quote, direct quote, names, likenesses and voices to creditors, ex-spouses, record producers, managers, and even Facebook. So essentially you open up this, she argues, this marketplace of identity, this secondary marketplace.
It's really, really fascinating. It's lots of implications, not just for actors, but also for, yeah, it was clear, yeah. Also for people, you know, like us, right? I think it's kind of scary to think that you could accidentally or deliberately sell your identity and then not own it anymore.
And this is the bit of the show where we reveal that it's been a deepfake Amit that has been hosting this episode.
I did write about this kind of similar. I did a piece about The Simpsons a couple of years ago, and we spoke about it on the podcast. And for that, I did make a deepfake Amit. Do you remember?
Didn't we have deepfake Amit introduce something on the show?
We tried to. Yeah, I don't think the technology available to us was quite up with the deepfake industry. But yeah, I did do a little piece about this a couple of years ago, which kind of touches on some of these same issues. The thing I'm interested in is, like, what does this mean for, like, up and coming actors? Like, if you're the next Tom Cruise, but they can just get Tom Cruise to, like, live forever as a deepfake, then where does that leave you?
Well, I mean, one of the experts I was speaking to was like, the one of the worries, and this I think they all agreed on, is that AI, you know, the actors don't understand the technology that they're getting involved with, and theoretically, you know, an AI could be trained in their mannerisms and then replace them long term. So yeah, that was definitely a worry, that we wouldn't need Bruce Willis anymore.
Interesting stuff. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. If you have any thoughts on this story or anything else we've talked about on the podcast recently, do let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. And we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.